And at this, the start of our last VFX show before Christmas, we just wanted to wish everyone a really happy and safe holidays. Thanks so much for your support this year, and we certainly hope to see you back in 2013 for a whole bunch of new VFX shows, including Star Trek 2, Iron Man 3, Pacific Rim, just a ton. And a particular shout out to listeners who are actually artists at the big studios who make the effects we so enjoy. Thanks so much. We just really appreciate it. Have a great holiday and a happy new year from everyone here at FX Guide. Hi, and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, joined by two regular VFX showers, Jason and Matt. How are you, Jason?
Pretty good.
Yeah, hanging in there. And yep. And Matt, yourself?
Awesome. Yeah, doing good.
So I've been traveling quite a lot. We're a little late in getting this next VFX show out. I apologize about it. Unfortunately, these guys have day jobs and I have... competing jobs is probably the best way to describe it, but we do appreciate you being with us here on the VFX show. Now, what we're going to be doing this week is comparing and contrasting. I think that's probably the wrong way to even approach it. We're having a look at two films by the same director that have similar visual effects in one sense, but are spanning quite a lot of years apart, and those films are Flight and Castaway. Robert Zemeckis, either side of his foray into heavily animated motion capture-based productions. Both of them, I think, are really, really good films. But let's see what the couch thinks. And over to you first, Jason. Did you like these films?
I did. From a Castaway perspective, I actually really loved Castaway, except for the end.
The end when he's back in the...
Yeah, with the Spielbergian literal crossroads, you know, shot with the fact... I don't know. I just want to get into it. It never sat right with me, but I do like the practical approach they took with having being able to take off, you know, 9 months or whatever it was, while Tom Hanks got super skinny, grew an actual beard and long hair, and I would have liked some intermediate stuff in between there as that was happening. But it's fine to do the now I'm super pro Robinson Crusoe guy and I can just get shit done. I was fine with that. But for Flight, I actually really liked it. And it was an interesting viewing because I was with you at Atomic Fiction when you interviewed the guys. And they gave away the ending while they were talking about some stuff. And my brother was with me and my friend Carol was with me. And they didn't know. So it was an interesting – I knew where it was going, so I wanted to see how they got there, and my brother didn't know. So I was interested in his opinion on how they got there.
Let's just flag that right now that if you haven't seen Flight and you want to see it, we're going to have to, for visual effects reasons, discuss a spoiler, and it's a quintessential spoiler. So if you haven't seen Flight and you want to see it, please pause, come back to this podcast because – I would hate to somebody to be most people have seen Castaway, I'm sure. If they haven't seen it by now, they're probably not likely to. But Flight is a really good film, and I'd recommend it. And we're going to have a really interesting discussion about it. But you're absolutely right, Jason. There is a major spoiler. So assuming that you've not paused now, we can keep going.
So I have to say that this was a spectacular – I won't get into breaking it down, but just from an esoteric standpoint, I think it's a spectacular airplane crash sequence. And I think this year has been particularly good for airplane crash sequences, including Joe Carnahan's The Gray, which is also a phenomenal film. But the plane crash sequence is in a totally different, a more violent vibe, but equally as nuts. This was sort of, the audience is the co-pilot trying not to freak out while they watch Denzel Washington work his magic. The pilot, main pilot, and calmly do what almost nobody else can do. I don't know. As a whole, I enjoyed the movie. I liked the twists and turns that they gave it, and how, other than the plane crash sequence and the end, there wasn't a huge amount of visual effects, and it was just storytelling. And they did a nice job with giving making Denzel Washington's character not so likable, which is not always the roles he plays.
And making a tiny single serve bottle of grog in a cabinet look really dramatic.
Yeah.
Okay, so there are other visual effects other than the ones you've mentioned, and we'll come back to them, much more in the category of invisible effects. But in this, but Matt, what about you?
Yeah, you know, Flight, I was kind of excited to see it just because I'm a big Denzel Washington fan. I mean, he's always so good, and a Robert Zemeckis fan too. And I think, you know, what was really neat about it is it really felt so much like... you know, a movie for grown-ups. It's the kind of movie that I don't think you see the big studios making very often anymore. And so I thought that in and of itself, you know, was, you know, kudos to the studio and to, you know, both the writer and the director and Mr. Washington for, you know, seeing that this film got made. I mean, I think it's really an excellent film. The effects, you know, which we'll get into, I really enjoyed. I thought they were really well done, well executed, and in, you know, some really interesting ways as well. And then the other film, Castaway, I haven't seen that in a long time, but you know, I remember seeing it in the theater, and I think when I was still living in San Francisco, and I certainly enjoyed it. It was, you know, it's an interesting, I would agree with you, Jason, about the end. And I think it's definitely one of those ones, the crash in it, I thought was really great, which we could talk about that too. For a couple particular reasons that still kind of vividly stick out in my mind. But then the other thing about it too, I guess, is just it's such an interesting conceit, you know, the idea of, you know, how do you tell a story about a singular human alone on an island, you know, and coming up with a way in which to tell that narrative. I think it's kind of interesting. It's almost sort of like an experimental narrative structure in that regard.
Yeah, I mean, I think we should point out the budgets at this point, because the budget is actually a lot smaller for Flight than it was for Castaway, which is kind of interesting, actually, if you think about it, because it obviously Robert Zemeckis and I think Denzel Washington, I'm pretty sure I'm saying this, deferred parts of their salary. So to say that the budget was $30 million, they may have, you know, some, I don't know, back-end kind of, you know, deal on this that would justify me saying that it's not, you know, quite as dramatic as a third, but it is basically a third as much. In other words, you know, $90 million to $30 million. The idea of this being an adult film, I think, is an interesting thing to explore because at $30 million, Robert Zemeckis has said he can make this film and it doesn't have to bust all box office. It doesn't have to be, you know, a mega summer tentpole. And as such, he's hoping that it will make money and thus allow films at this level to be made. I think personally, there's another aspect to this, which is the role of visual effects in the $30 million film, because mm-hmm. it allows a $30 million film, as long as it's got solid acting and a good story, to compete and not look like an indie or a, you know, low budget or whatever kind of a film. And I think this does. I believe this film's already grossed $90 million. That sounds like another money. It's a different $90 million than the Castaway. But yeah, so it's, you know, should be therefore deemed a major financial success. And if it continues to do well with overseas and stuff, you know, and it does say $100 million, then it's a hugely successful film. Yet if it had cost, you know, $100 million, it would be a flop. And I think his point is well made, that maybe this is what we have to do. We have to make these lower budget films if we want to tackle kind of more actor-driven stories. And if visual effects can help provide punch to just part of that film for the storytelling, then now we're in good stead. Because obviously you couldn't have had visual effects all the way through it, wall to wall, for that $30 million budget. But the effects we do have, and I think there are three or four major sequences, but probably I'm going to call about three, really, really serve a purpose. I'm sure you'd agree, Matt.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, the work that Atomic Fiction pulled off with the budget that they had, I mean, it's really impressive. And it really does go to helping sort of construct and create sort of a believable world around this, you know, kind of larger narrative that's going on, sort of this internal, sort of this internal struggle that this character is going through, that's, you know, externalized through this kind of extraordinary set of circumstances. And, yeah, I mean, the effects work that they delivered, I think, was just it's totally solid, and it adds so much production value to, you know, I mean, you know, we say $31 million or $30 million budget is a low budget. I mean, that's actually, I mean, I think a pretty, you know, nice budget. It's a low budget for this amount of effects work, though, I would say.
And an A-grade director with an A-grade actor, you know, I mean, it is still a studio film.
And an A-grade DP, you know, Don Burgess is no,
no Don Burgess is
slouch, you know.
I mean, the other thing we should point out about Castaway at $90 million is that's a couple of hundred million in today's dollars. I remember when Castaway was made, it was thought to be a very big budget film. It wasn't.
But also at the time that, if I'm not mistaken, at the time, what year did Castaway come out? At the year that came out, what was it?
2000.
Oh, it was 2000. Yeah. So, I mean, it was a slightly different, you know, era in terms of, you know, both the star vehicle as well as, you know, the kind of escalating budgets and stuff. I think it was a slightly different time. I think there's been some shifts and changes overall in the industry between, you know, in the last 10 years, for sure.
Well also huge shift between 35 millimeter film on Castaway and Red Epic on the digitally shot.
Yeah,
on.
just technologically speaking, yeah. I mean, and when it comes to the effects budget, you know, which I think you talked about some with the supervisor, Bailey, right?
Yeah. So are you going to say something?
I was going to say even numbers slashed in shooting days. I mean, Zemeckis said he normally would do this in 70 days, and he shot it in 45, which is like, for these guys, breakneck speed, you know? For dudes who are used to being able to take their time to find their moments and find the beats that they want, to have to, like, kick it into gear. You know, it sounds ridiculous to look at it from a non-Zemeckis side to say, $30 million in 45 days? Jeez, you know, wow, boo-hoo. But in reality, when you're functioning at that level and you're working, especially coming from a historical perspective, everyone on from, like I said, DP, director, A-list actors used to working at a much more, let's say, comfortable speed.
You know, yeah, it's a top shelf A-list movie, you know, regardless of the budget.
Yeah. Put in a squeezed situation, and I think they came out on top as they should have.
Let's discuss the visual effects in Castaway in terms of the plane crash, and then we can compare it with Flight. So I found it very visceral when the plane goes down in Castaway. He's in the baggage of the compartment that holds the packages, and he's not therefore in a kind of familiar, you know, plane environment. And there was, it was a dark, it was very much sort of an interior we stayed with Tom Hanks kind of experience. And I found it as such, as it, even though it had this huge budget, it could have gone for, you know, shooting a lot more kind of exterior shots and plane flying past camera and stuff. But the fact that we stayed interior a lot made it kind of terrifying, because we didn't feel like Tom Hanks was in control. In some way, we couldn't kind of work out what the hell was going on with the plane ourselves.
Totally. And I was going to say, too, you know, the moment in that crash that I alluded to earlier, which to me still sticks out in my mind. If I think about Castaway and I think specifically about the plane crash, the image that immediately comes to mind, I think, like you say, there's very few, if any, exterior shots of the plane. I can't recall exactly, but most sort of almost stomach churning and really anxiety provoking moment is when you see sort of Tom Hanks' character's point of view through the cockpit window and sort of the clouds part, and you see the tumultuous sort of stormy ocean rapidly approaching through the cockpit window. And I remember seeing that in the theater and just being like, oh, you know, it's one of those things, anytime you're on a plane, you know, if you know you're in rough turbulence or something, I always picture that moment in my head. It's really, really arresting and effective as a way of heightening sort of the sense of realism and the lack of control that you feel as a passenger, and putting you in that space in a really dramatic way, cinematically.
Well, yeah. And after that too, when he's underwater and the camera comes up and they do the audio mute to cut, you know, above when he gets above, like your ears are with the camera, and he comes up and everything's on fire on the ocean, and he goes back under.
Yeah.
I mean, those kind of like you said, it puts you in the visceral POV of Tom Hanks, but it's also a very dramatic way to give you glimpses of an insanely dramatic situation that you kind of almost don't want to see, but at the same time you're like, holy crap, there's a plane just like, you know, on fire in the ocean at night. What do you do?
Yeah, in talking about flight, when a reporter asked him, Zemeckis discussed that idea of staying with the characters, and he stayed with a few characters in Flight because there was more than just sort of the Tom Hanks in the character cast. You know, there was the hostess and stuff and the co-pilot, but he stayed with them. He didn't keep on jumping around all over the plane and going to 15 different sub-stories. And I guess that's the experience of a Zemeckis, right? To like know when it's a good idea to stay with just a couple of characters and when it's a good idea to go differently, because the temptation, especially in Flight sequence, would have been to play out various subplots as various people were going to die in the crash. And and there's a little bit of that, but mainly we're just stuck with that, the audience, I guess, being articulated through the co-pilot with what the heck are we doing and why are we doing it, and this almost steel-willed knowledge of what he needs to do to pull the plane down, or get the plane down safely, that that the captain seems to exhibit. And I just think that directorial decision, I don't know I'd have had the nerve to do that. Would you, Jason?
Well, the interesting thing is, I think I was counting in my head while you're talking. I think there's maybe only four exterior shots, really. There's the wing hitting the plane, which you see, or the wing hitting the church,
yeah,
which you see from inside the cockpit first, as they see the church coming up, and you're like, oh crap, they're going to hit the church, and the wing clips it. You see the upside down shot from, I think it's two shots, a wide, and then from Nicole's point of view, or one of the, or the what's it called's point of view, the landlord's,
the hillbilly landlord,
yeah, hillbilly landlord's point of view, and then the exterior. I think there's only one more. Like that's like you said, that's a pretty bold choice to not exploit like an upside down plane and a plane diving and all that stuff, and it's way more visceral interior. But he did the really subtle ticks of the boxes, like what's going to cause drama in the cockpit. We know it's going to be dramatic when a plane rolls, or the passengers know they're crashing, right? So he just does the one little storyline with the kid falling out of the seat, which is just all you need, because you know everyone else is going to freak out. And they also do the one thing that you assume is going to happen in every movie, is someone's not going to have their seatbelt in, the stewardess, and she hits the ceiling when it hits a dive or something. Like that happens in every plane crash movie. Somebody goes up to the roof. So it gives you like the one or two key things. You get to feel because you just saw the girl indulging in drugs and alcohol with Denzel Washington. You get to see her be heroic, so it can sort of cap off her character for the rest of the movie. And it's like just enough of that stuff. I think my favorite line is when Denzel Washington sits the other stewardess down in the cockpit, and he's telling her to say,
speaking of the black box. Yeah, I know. Yeah, that is like, just, that's what got me. I mean, that was
brilliant.
You can call it a Spielberg kind of, you know, but I don't care. Like that's what films need to deliver. They need to have some emotional kind of, you cared now. Because it wasn't like, you know, I'm never going to see my son again kind of throwaway line that told me that she was a mother. It was a heartfelt, took me to like a, you know, two beats to kind of put it together, sort of, you know, when he first says it. And then you go, oh my God, you know, of course, that's a brilliant
horrifying
thing to do. Yeah.
And
No, I mean, and then that carried it, I think, emotionally. And that's, So I think that's a really good thing. The other thing, just now, purely from a VFX point of view, is that we discussed the budget in terms of the VFX, but the special effects to pull that off would have chomped into a fair amount of money, because they built some really good gimbal rigs for filming on. And so for that cockpit to do what it needed to do, it needed to be able to be articulated to sort of go down and up and stuff. And then there were entire circular rigs, so in other words, sections of the plane that were inside a tube that could spin upside down. And so you can't spin, in this case it was done in two sections, and we'll come back to that, but you can't spin like, what is that, like 10 rows of six across kind of seats upside down in a lightweight rig. Like that's a huge amount of actual construction to make sure that's a safe rig. Now, pays off enormously, but special effects were given a sizable amount of money, clearly, and it worked. And that's another reason why I think at 30 million, they were, you know, this is not like you're giving you a lot for your money.
Yeah, definitely.
Hey, speaking of that, Matt, do you want to articulate or explain for people, if you've probably seen it because we put it in FX Guide TV, how that two section worked that I just alluded to?
Yeah, so I mean, there were a couple different rigs, right? I mean, that, as you were saying, there was a primary cockpit rig, and then a fairly lengthy sort of main cabin rig that was set up to do sort of the like jostling of passengers, right? So you kind of get people's heads bobbing up and down, and they could do the tilting forward and the tilting backward and stuff. So you'd get kind of that real natural kind of physics motion that you'd expect to see in passengers in a plane. And then they had, for just the primary cockpit itself, they had constructed, again, another, you know, pretty significant rig, and one, like you say, that, you know, definitely had to be pretty safe in order for this to work right. But it was set up where it had there was like a wheel that drove it, and a belt that went around this wheel, hooked up to some kind of a mechanism that allowed them to be able to rotate the entire cockpit, full 360 degrees, on its nose axis, right? So like as if it were rolling, and that was set up just with the primary cockpit, and they were able to get, you know, a lot of great shots of both Denzel Washington, the co-pilot, as well as the stewardess who was in there, with everything kind of floating up to the ceiling, as well as like them shifting their weight and sort of, you know, bracing in order to sort of go with the roll of the aircraft. And then for the main passenger cabin, they had one section that was, I don't know if it was maybe like what, like 10 or so rows at the most. Which worked great for, you know, set shots in that compartment. But if you were doing like a shot that was looking sort of like, if you imagine being in the, in the back of a plane where there's like the bathroom, right? And you're standing in the aisle and you're looking towards the cockpit, you know, you're seeing probably what, like, you know, 30 rows of seats. And so what they did on that was they actually shot the primary section with the camera, you know, essentially up close, and got the roll and the pitch and all the action that they wanted to get. And then they actually moved the camera back so that they were, you know, almost another full section behind the rig. So it was as if it were further down, and then shot and tried to match as close as they could the moves that they were doing in terms of the rotation. And then they wound up doing at Atomic Fiction, they did in Nuke, I think it was, right? They said they were doing some retiming and a lot of optical flow in order to get those two sections to sort of line up as if it were all just one long tubule within the aircraft itself. So in that way, they were able to get, again, you know, in a really creative solution, a lot of great bang for their buck without having to build, you know, something that probably would have been impossible to build in terms of the size and the weight of the thing. And they were able to achieve, I think, a really just amazingly successful effect through some pretty creative problem solving.
Yeah, and I think that stitching those two together and making it all work did a really good job. But as regular listeners will know, my yardstick of visual effects is whether it looks good out the window. Now, in Castaway coming down, it's pretty black, and it really isn't a fair comparison. But in flight, there's a lot of shots of clouds out windows, and generally shots in planes. We all know what that should look like because we've all been on planes. Let me reserve my judgment. But Jason, do you think out the window looked fake, or do you think out the windows looked good?
I thought out the windows looked good. I thought it was interesting that they had it be raining, which obviously helps a lot. I believe the wipers were CG even, to just, you know, they just had the clean green screen on set, and then put all that in afterwards. And I think it made it for the drama to get and punch through that hole in the clouds, which was a nice beginning drama, and then everything goes to shit after that when you think you're okay, which is another nice Zemeckis little tweak to the audience. I didn't have any problem. Nothing really stuck out to me, and the windows are so small, and it does such a great job of focusing your attention on the characters and what's going on, that even if there were some janky shots, which I'm not saying there were, I don't think you even would have noticed it. Because
I think the crazing on the glass, and by that I mean that sort of little micro fractury type look that you get on the, those airport plane windows, airplane windows, and that sort of general smudginess and stuff, it was well crafted, that kind of, because window glass in planes, you know, and who hasn't stared at it on long flights, is quite interesting. It's not a clean window.
It's like chromatically aberrated on the edges and has that weird bend to it where everything bends around the corner.
Yeah. It's quite an interesting thing, really. And so, yeah, and I thought that was well handled. And whether or not you needed to go further to match reality, I don't care. Like, I'm not saying that they should have got the exposure interior and exterior exactly right to just satisfy me. It needed to be enough out that it didn't feel fake, but not so far out that it didn't make for good storytelling because it just looked like white out the windows.
And well, so the best part is that no one really knows what it looks like out the cockpit window, right? And how many people are in the cockpit that often? Like, it's a nice license.
When I kind of thought too that there were a few moments where, you know, it certainly in the some of the opening establishing shots of the airport when sort of Denzel Washington arrives at the airport and sort of doing the walk around of the plane after we've seen him sort of, you know, piecing himself together after his night of typical debauchery for him, I guess. And then he's sort of doing his walk around and you see all this activity and they show a large vista of the airport with an airplane taking off and stuff. And I had this thought initially watching it that, you know, some of the stuff, it almost felt like it was just so clean and pristine. But I also kind of feel like, in a way, there's kind of a stylization thing that's going on. But it's there's a realism, but also there's a style. There's definitely a cinematic kind of style to the whole picture. And I thought, in that regard, any sort of dreamlike quality that you might have seen in certainly that one big shot of the airport where I know they did a lot of like sky replacements and retimed everything to make it look like, you know, big, heavy, stormy weather as opposed to, I think, what was a bright, shiny day when they shot it. But so it took on this kind of veneer of something that looked almost too clean in a strange kind of way. That's the only word I can think to describe it. But it was, I think, it felt maybe more like a choice in terms of a style rather than a you know, like some sort of a mistake, you know.
If I can switch to other mistakes in Castaway, the one that bothered me, and I mean, I sail and stuff, and I spend a lot of time on the water. The one that bothered me in Castaway is when he got to the top of the island and looked down, and all the waves seemed to be coming in to the island in exactly the same direction, which was exact to say, you know, 90 degrees to the island. So they had to establish that he was on the island, but you look down at the waves, and the first time I saw it, it looked kind of wrong, and I couldn't articulate why. It was a green screen shot from high up. You guys know what I'm talking about? Tom Hanks climbs up to the thing. And then later, when I got to look at the shot in a making of, I think, or in a Cinefix, I remember noticing suddenly that all the waves were just hitting the island unrealistically. And I think this goes to a central problem in visual effects, which is sometimes you want the story to do something for story reasons, and sometimes nature doesn't do that. And the problem is you can sometimes know it's wrong but not say why. So in my case, I just sensed that the island looked wrong in that shot, and I if you'd have pushed me at the moment, I would have said, oh, I don't focus or something. But it wasn't. It was just, you know, wave characteristics of having every wave come in. Now, that was a Sony Imageworks picture, if I recall correctly, right? Castaway. And it was and it's a difficult problem, right? Because, you know, if you obviously could see that the waves didn't stop him from getting off in one direction, you know, just go off in that direction, you stupid fool. you know, but other than that, I sort of thought that the extensive use of green screen or whatever else that they were doing didn't portray the film, because it was very important that we felt like it was on an island, and obviously a lot of it was shot on Fiji. And when there were studio elements, they had to match really, really well. And I think that they did. But it is tough when the director asks the VFX team to come up with something that they need for the plot, so you can't just dismiss it, but it just doesn't actually work because things don't work like that.
I just remember that shot being, I believe it's, I know two of them. I think it's that one. When he's up on there at sunset, right? That's the first one.
Yes, because he goes back to get the extra rope later, having failed to hang himself. But we didn't see that at the time. Yeah,
it's that sunset shot that I remember. It's a beautiful shot, but there's no other shots like that in the movie, and it felt like a shot out of Gone with the Wind to me.
Yeah, like there's sort of big, super saturated, epic
sunset, wide, close. Shot. It's a great shot, but it didn't stick out to me as being bad. It's just stylistically, it's not as raw of a shot, and which it doesn't have to be. I mean, it's a very emotional moment for him, so it should be this kind of maybe tonally different shot.
Yeah. Well, Ken Rolston was the VFX supervisor on that film, and extremely good VFX supervisor.
Oh, yeah.
And well-known throughout the industry. What are you laughing about?
Oh, I mean, Ken Ralston. I mean, he's like, you know, top of the list in my book.
Well, he's only won 4 Oscars, but, you know, that's not too bad. Yeah,
not too shabby.
Okay, well, I mean, obviously for some of us in the industry, Ken is super well-known, but maybe for some people listening, he isn't quite as well-known, but he should be because he is one of the industry's best VFX supervisors. So I'm just reading now Cocoon, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is probably the high point for me in terms of just unbelievable effects pulled off in a pre-digital age. And then he also won for Death Becomes Her and Forrest Gump. And this film comes, what, about 2 or 3 years, maybe even longer, maybe 5 years after Forrest Gump, and it was a period when Tom Hanks was on a real roll, because it was Forrest Gump, and there was Philadelphia and a couple of other huge films that he was in. So there was obviously a lot of firepower going into to Castaway, but we didn't have. I mean, there was some digital water and stuff done, but back in 2000, doing that sort of stuff was a heck of a lot harder than it is today. You know, rendering technology, everything, you know, 12 years ago is just a hell of a long time in VFX. It's interesting because they did do things like, as I say, the high shots on the cliff as pure studio work. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, it benefited a lot from this practical approach. And let's face it, the center of that is the fact that we had an actor that was willing to starve himself for 9 months between the first shoot and the second, so that you got this really great natural loss in weight between him being on the island, having just landed on an American Western kind of diet, and having survived on what is basically some fish and coconuts from the time after that. And that sold it a lot. And at the time, I remember being particularly impressed with that, having also been seriously interested in why I kept on seeing press photos of Tom Hanks growing a beard. I did feel that, like, that was something at the time we couldn't have done digitally. Today, you could probably digitally remove body weight, and it would be a hard exercise, but you could probably pull it off.
Steve was a perfect example of that.
But back then, there was no other way to do that, and it really was a monumental cheat that visual effects couldn't have provided. Was there anything in Flight? I think we should maybe swing back to the opening of Flight, because we sort of went straight into the crash, which is awesome. But I was particularly impressed when I discovered only later that the opening sequence at the airport was all shot on a bright and sunny day. Jason?
Yeah.
Because you didn't name that at the beginning when you were talking about the effects, but there was quite a few shots when he was checking out the plane and all that kind of stuff when it was sunny.
Yeah, and I believe from what they said in the interview, they weren't given a hell of a lot of time at the airport to shoot, right?
Correct.
And obviously you don't have the serendipity of it being a really stormy day, and you got to get what you can get and work with it later.
I mean, there were big cranes holding big rainmaking equipment, and they did manage to shoot the plane in shadow, because that's one of the things that always gives away day for night shots, as well as, you know, re-timing in terms of coloring it to make it look like it's stormy and not sunny, which is you just can't get rid of those high-con shadows.
Yeah.
So that was pivotal. But that being said, a lot of the airport wasn't there. A lot of the conditions were completely different. I wasn't even aware that was an effect sequence.
Yeah, I wasn't either. Watching the film, I had no idea that it was an effect sequence until watching the the effects guide TV piece. But I thought too, the other thing, you know, the map painting stuff for the really big sort of thunderhead stormy skies, like when you see I believe it's prior to the walk around where you see sort of that establishing shot. I think it might be the first one of the first shots in the movie, but maybe after the opening scene, I can't quite remember. Maybe it's when he's first coming to the airport and you see like a plane taking off, and there's these huge sort of thunderhead, you know, cumulonimbus kind of clouds, and there's a small opening, but you can sort of see all this really harsh weather is coming in to really engulf the entire sky. And I thought that stuff was really good. It looked really nice.
Okay, so I gave you a spoiler alert. This is your last chance. Super spoiler alert. Stop now. So what do we think of that final end transition, which was, Jason, an absolutely pivotal plot point?
Literally pivoting.
Yep.
I see, that was one of the shots that they gave away in the interview when we were there, and I was really excited to see that shot now, having heard about it, how it was done before I saw the shot. And for people who now will be spoiled or know what we're talking about, is they come into Denzel Washington in the courtroom in a close shot, and then pivot around his face and then back out from, you know, like basically eye to eye, eye around and then back out on the other eye. And you're going in the courtroom and coming out in prison in like an AA or NA group, you know, talking about, and he's been in prison X amount of time, and you find out that the courtroom did end with him going to prison. And I think their solution to that was brilliant. And it, you know, it's people, like, I'm not a huge fan of 3D movies in stereo, but that technology is what allowed them to pull off that shot, because they basically eye matched and approximated those two shots. They weren't motion control, and they came in on did the all the way around on the courtroom, and then came in and did the all the way around on the prison set. And then they realized that they could use Ocula in Nuke to basically tell Nuke that it was a stereo, and use the tools in Ocula to A, align them and register them, but also transition between them in the move, which I thought when he was describing that in the interview was just genius.
I agree. It was. And we had the benefit of knowing that. Matt, you didn't presumably know that? I think we even cut it out of FX Guide TV.
I didn't know that. I did not know that, although, you know, what is so cool is listening to that being described, like, I totally remember the shot, and it's really powerful when you see it in the film, because it's such a – it's a really strong – I mean, it is the, you know, narrative bullet, you know, at the end of the story that really – although there actually, I think, was one more bullet. You talked about the line that got you, but the one that got me came from his son at the very end when he talks about the title of the essay that he had to write. That was – yeah. That was pretty awesome. But you know, they kind of cinematically – I mean, what I think is so neat throughout the film – is that, you know, Zemeckis employed this really cool technique where he didn't do that, you know, actual sort of morph transition like at the very end. He sort of saved that as the big money shot. But there were a number of key moments in the film where you weren't really sure where you were in the timeline of the narrative. And as it sort of became revealed, you know, you saw that you were, oh, we're back like at an earlier point sort of prior to the crash, or, oh, this is after the crash and he's, you know, trying to, you know, do this. And so there was this kind of jumbled juxtaposition of story elements that were told cinematically. But then that last shot, you know, with the transition is such a great example of both sort of the, you know, the artifice of sort of the cinema and the story, as well as like, you know, that really pretty awesome effects solution. Narratively, like all sort of coming together and meshing in a really potent way that just accentuates the, you know, the meaning of both the narrative and the key story point for that character. I mean, it can't imagine it coming together in a better way. It just was so awesome.
Well, and you know, this is like he like quoted himself. If this was a solo in a band, he quoted himself sort of twice in this movie in reference to all other movies, in that he has a plane crash sequence, which he has in Castaway, which he doesn't have in any of his other movies, I don't believe. And then he has this ending courtroom sequence, which is very similar to the end of Contact. So which is one of my favorite films, but it's interesting that he wasn't afraid to sort of go into familiar territory, which he doesn't normally do, and take it in a different direction and have it be just as impactful.
I mean, you quoted Contact there, 97, that film was made, and had, you know, as probably people who listen to the show know, one of my all-time favorite shots ever, with the girl running to the medicine cabinet and pulling out. And I feel like Zemeckis is so technically literate, because this is a guy that did a ton of visual effects. You mentioned Roger Rabbit, but, you know, Back to the Future, Death Becomes a Forrest Gump was breakthrough in its day, and that won him the Oscar. So obviously super technically literate. He's not afraid in a narrative piece, and I know that Contact has a lot of sci-fi at the end, but at that point in the movie, with mainly, you know, feels non-effects driven, he's not afraid to do something that some people might say would draw attention to the camera itself, and that would be a no-no, but he's happy to do it because there's a wowness to it that you're kind of with him. I don't know why, but I don't push back on a complex scene like that one in Contact, all the eye scene in this, and say, hang on a second, I'm taken out of the film and I'm, you know, blah, blah, blah. I'm right there with him. He, I think you pointed out, Jason, he uses it very judiciously, and when he uses it, he just knocks it out of the park.
And he's a great live action director. I mean, I think, you know, this film, you know, there were a lot of stories. I heard another interview with him on, I think it was on the business with Kim Masters, and they were talking, and that, you know, everybody was just, you know, kind of so giddy with excitement, you know, the thought that Robert Zemeckis was returning to make a live action film, you know, and he sort of poo pooed that idea, saying, well, you know, it's all the same kind of thing, you know, it's like it's a, you know, it's filmmaking either way, whether you're doing it with an all digital cast or if you're making a live action film with, you know, living actors present in the moment. But he's just a great live action director, and I think
I'm going to argue that I don't think I would have liked a film. I can't imagine a film that he could have made where we saw a digital synthetic Denzel Washington motion captured in any position.
It's quoting Zemeckis there.
No, I know, but I'm just saying.
I'm with you, but like I would, you know, quibble with that point too. But I think, you know, at the same point, he's doing his, you know, it's a PR interview moment, right? I mean, it's like it's true. I would concur, I think, with where you're headed there.
Because he's come back from these years in, you know, motion capture, Uncanny Valley kind of thing. And obviously he's answering that criticism. Obviously he's addressing that issue a lot in interviews, and I don't want to say that he shouldn't have done it, because he's a filmmaker and do anything he wants, but there's no doubt that in my mind nothing he made between Contact and Flight had me as emotionally nailed as her speaking into the black spot recorder as it was in Flight. I have to go back to before he, you know, to around Contact time before I get that kind of punch from him. And I'm a guy who likes tech and likes visual effects, and, you know, put it this way, and I know he did a lot of stuff, but, and I pushed the frontiers and contributed to the craft, but there's just nothing in, you know, any of those films like Christmas Carol or Beowulf or...
Yeah, and I guess I would totally agree with that. I just think, you know, it's interesting to look at those things as, you know, experiments, you know, like you said, experiments with the craft or technical experiments, you know, but even the state of the art of like a digital synthespian, at least at the time that he was, you know, making, whether it was Polar Express or Beowulf 3D or whatever the last one was, you know, the sort of the height of what you could do in an all digital animated character to convey that level of, well, I don't know if I even agree with my own statement there, like, but it never quite succeeded. And so, yeah, to see him come back and do something that has this much heart and this much brain in it, you know, I think is just, it's so satisfying to the, you know, to the palate, you know, it's really a return to, like, you know, his A form, I think.
Can I also say, actually dovetailing right into that, is that and from what you said earlier about it being an adult piece, you know, this is a pretty serious film. I mean, it's got, you know, Denzel Washington is a master of being able to flip-flop a dramatic scene with a little zing of not comedy, but brevity, I guess is a better word for it. And this is a movie about substance abuse and addiction, and from multiple angles, and characters who've gotten over, characters who don't, characters who enable it, like John Goodman's character, who initially I thought was like, wow, they really just like, he's in the trailer, he's in everything, and he was in it for like one scene, and then he's gone. And in the trailer, they almost set it up like he's his like rehab coach in a weird way. And then he's gone. Like, it's like, you're like, oh, I thought Forrest Whitaker would have played that part, you know, like, but, and then when they, the way that they bring him back in the end is brilliant. Although I have to say, no one should be able to use Gimme Shelter in a movie ever again. Scorsese already used it in The Departed, which was retarded. And for Zemeckis to use it also, I get it that he used it as John Goodman's theme song, but come on. It's ridiculous. Anyway.
It is one of the all-time great songs, though.
Yes, that's fine, and I'll listen to it on my stereo. I don't want it shoved in a movie when it's already iconically linked to another. You know, he might as well use the Star Wars theme song somewhere. You know what I mean, but anyway,
it is great live. Have you seen it live? I mean, you must have, right?
No, I've never seen the Rolling Stones.
Oh man, okay.
I'm not a huge Rolling Stones fan, so right, I'll just throw that out there.
People can
send me hate mail now.
No,
but. But I like Mick Taylor.
Last time I saw them, literally Keith stepped on stage at one point and he had like a solo, and then he stops and he goes, he's in Sydney, millions of people in the audience. Yeah, I just want to say it's really good to be, anywhere.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, way to go, Keith.
Yeah, his roadie didn't write Sydney on the back of his guitar that night.
Anyway.
Apart from that, this movie is you know, dealing with a pretty heavy subject matter all the way through, and it's not afraid to basically show its main character fail throughout the entire movie and to show the corrupt system that's willing to support him to uphold corporate ideals and other, you know, pretty serious situations. And having very recently lost someone very close to me to drug and alcohol abuse, it was very accurate to how it would affect the people around him and how he himself would be dealing with it. And that's really hard to do without being super cliche. Like the only other harder thing to do is literally act retarded. Like, and I'm not using that word derogatorily, but like, you know, Sean Penn or Giovanni Ribisi or I think John Hawks does in this movie in The Sessions that I haven't seen yet, but he plays a guy in an iron lung who has like one moving body part. Like those, it's very hard to do that without coming off as caricature, even if you don't mean that. And I think they did a really good job of showing his struggle narratively without being heavy-handed.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that and the assertions you made earlier, which is that this is an actor we're seeing at the height of his peak, and that peak has been around for a while, I guess, but he's just there are actors that are famous for being a bit famous, and then there are actors that are famous for being just really good at acting. I don't even know the last time I heard of Denzel Washington outside an acting role. Like, I guess I don't read gossip magazines anyway, but you know what I mean? Like, this is a guy who's... there's a lot of opportunity for him to act in this film, but he's just a very good actor.
Yeah.
Okay, so we just should sort of like close out this gap period, but that Zemeckis did, because it is the elephant in the room. We've talked about it a little bit. You know, he goes off and does these films that cost a lot of money. Many of them are okay. None of them, I think, are exceptionally great. He returns to live action with this small film. I guess the killer question is, where to next? Do we want to see Zemeckis go back for the, you know, Forrest Gumpy level, Back to the Future, huge kind of stuff, and heavy effects work? Or do you think that just speaking as filmgoers, we want to see him using effects like he is here, where it's really impactful. But let's face it, like percentage-wise, low body count.
I think whatever he makes, I'll go see it, you know, because I think he's an interesting artist who's sort of working through, you know, his own sort of thing, you know, kind of dealing with his own craft and sort of seeing where it takes him and what he does. I think, you know, this was a great choice. You know, the other credit I think for this film too has got to go to the screenwriter too. I think it's John either Gatkins or Gatkins. I'm not sure how he says his last name, but there was a great interview with him on the Jeff Goldsmith podcast, which has a new name. I can't remember what it's called now, but a really fantastic interview where he goes into talking about a lot of the machinations that the script went through. But you know, whatever Zemeckis goes on to do, like I would hope he would make more of this kind of film, you know, more of this kind of adult drama, because I think he's just really good at it. I feel like it's his wheelhouse in my book. But yeah, whatever he makes, I'll go check it out for sure.
Yeah, I would prefer that he do live action personally. Not that I didn't like the animated stuff, but I just think he's such a good live action director and storyteller that I want to go see forward to seeing more Zemeckis movies in the theater. I think he should just pick a Kurt Vonnegut book and just adapt it and make it, because that's in his wheelhouse too. He can totally ride that line.
And I want to give a shout out again to Kevin Bailey at Atomic Fission, who was the VFX supervisor of the whole film, because, you know, we're comparing a Ken Ralston film that by today's budget's hundreds of millions of dollars against a $30 million film that Kevin is, you know, holding his own in. And that's a heck of a thing to be saying. I mean, I wouldn't want to be pitched against Ken Ralston, no matter how much money I had, yet alone a fraction of the budget that he had. So I think the guys at Atomic Fiction, if you don't know, relatively new company, been around for a few years, but up in sort of San Fran near, pretty much near Pixar, around the kind of corner from them, and in Emeryville. And they're just a great small creative shop who don't spend a lot of time and energy on building up massive render farms, as we discussed in a separate story. They do a lot of stuff in a cloud computing sense and spend their money wisely. But like when we first visited them, they were first set up, there was a lot of room to move and a reception desk. When we went to see them this time, Jason, it was like literally we had to sort of stand in the car park. They were full to the rafters, which is...
Yeah, everyone's got headphones on. There's no walls.
Yeah. It's just packed in, but not packed in like a nasty way. It was a really nice space, but it was just clearly they're kicking it. And congratulations to them, because really it is almost a cruel comparison to put these two films back to back. And yet they, of course, are either side of this body of work that the director has done.
Well, they worked on another film, that Looper, which was also similarly, you could use the word handicap budgetarily, I think almost the same budget number, that did a similar layout to Flight, where they put a lot of more visual effects up front and then spent the rest of the time on a farm, which is sort of similar to Flight, and then have a nice little zinger at the end visual effects wise. And, you know, those are two movies they should be very proud of.
Absolutely. And you know what?
Definitely.
I mean, if you can come up with a good business model that's servicing a particular area, and I loved Looper, then, you know, I would be really proud to have either of those two films on my IMDb account. By way of trivia, like we do research for the shows, and every once in a while, you know, you come up with stuff that you don't know, and a lot of stuff obviously comes out on these films and you do know it. But there were two things I found out about Castaway that I didn't know, that I just thought were hysterically funny, and I just wanted to completely got nothing to do with visual effects, go down a rat hole. One of them was, apparently in the film, which I never even remembered hearing, As Good As It Gets, Helen Hunt's character is doing something, and apparently one of the other characters says this offhand line to her about how great she is, and he says, "You're the reason cavemen chisel on walls," and I don't even remember the line, but apparently that's a reference to the fact that it's Helen Hunt's picture on the wall of the Castaway cave,
right.
That he's in, which I just thought was just hysterically funny. I mean, I know it just got nothing to do with anything, right? And the second thing that I thought was really funny is obviously, and look, there's been entire TED speeches about this from J.J. Abrams, this idea of the unopened package, the unopened box. It just provides real dramatic interest to an audience. And so clearly in Castaway, there's this unopened FedEx box, and he, you know, doesn't open it and returns it at the end. And everybody asked Robert Zemeckis what it was. And normally, I think Robert Zemeckis had just deflected the question, but finally, at apparently some USC auditorium, they had a question and answer session. The director, you know, was asked once again, what was in the unopened package that Tom Hanks carried all the way back and delivered at the end of the film? And he responded that it was absolutely a waterproof, solar-powered satellite phone.
That's a brilliant answer. I like to, personally, I like to think of Castaway as Joe versus the volcano too.
Oh, yow. That's a stinger.
I love Joe versus the volcano, so that is not a dig in any sense of the word.
Really? Okay. And you haven't seen the Rolling Stones live. Jason, we really must
talk. Yeah, well.
This isn't your brother, is it? You haven't switched places? No? Okay.
No, he would say the exact same thing I did, so you would never know, actually.
Okay. For those of you who don't know, that Jason has a brother who is very, very similar in age and appearance.
Yes.
So, guys, where can people find you? Matt, where's a good place for people to on Twitter?
You can find me on the Twitters at Matt Wallen or at mattwallen.com or at Virginia Commonwealth University, where the semester just ended and we just got in my department a MakerBot Replicator 2.
Oh.
And I am going to be playing around making my 100 micron little 3D printouts. I'm so excited.
Wow.
I'm going to be calling you.
Yes.
It's playtime in the lab.
After our 007 Skyfall episode, we've discovered you can make an entire Aston Martin and blow it up with that thing.
yeah.
Jason, what about you?
You can find me on the Twitters at Jason Diamond, one word, and thediamondbros.com.
And, of course, you can find me over on FX Guide. We've got a bunch of interesting stuff happening over at FX Guide. There's some good stories. The one we've been referring to in this podcast, because the film Flight didn't have an enormous number of stories about it, is episode 160. So if you're looking for FX Guide TV 160, it's the one that actually shows you those rigs for the gimbals and stuff. And it was an interview that I did that Jason shot in San Fran. So thanks to those guys for that. And there's also a bunch of other interesting stuff going on there, including a bunch of interesting stuff we've started posting in the gaming area, especially a real-time water sim stuff that was posted this week, which has had a really good response. Had a look at Assassin's Creed 3. So check that out and check out our other podcasts. Thanks so much. And if we don't get to talk to you again before Christmas, have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Please be safe and enjoy the holiday festivities. Thanks so much from all of us here at FX Guide. See ya.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2012, FX Guide, LLC.